Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and we're hoping that you're taking full advantage of the, what would you call the celebratory nature of this time of year. Today, well, we celebrate anytime we get anything to eat from Olympia Provisions. We also can bring you another edition of the hearty cold weather soups and stews from the South.
And don't get mad, all you vegetarians and vegans, don't get mad at us for having so much meat in the early part of the program, because there's a very interesting track from the Vegetarian Resource Group.
Yes.
Coming at the end of the program. So hang with the carnivores for just a little bit, and you'll have your own time in the sun.
Eli Cairo, we know your product. Your product is charcuterie, is absolutely fantastic. And your work ethic, your attitude towards the whole purpose of eating and drinking is a marvel. So your business is called now Olympia Provisions. But you've been in operation in Portland, Oregon since 2009. And in your book called Olympia Provisions, for some reason, you talk about where you've been in your life. And that in itself is a story that to just totally engross the reader. Tell us a little bit. Can you condense it?
Yeah, I'll give you the cliff notes in a hurry of the history of me. Yeah, grew up Greek in an amazing family that loved food, owned restaurants. And about 19 years old, they shipped me off to a small little village in Switzerland where I was fortunate enough to live and work with some of the most amazing, hardworking, talented producers / cooks I've ever met in my life. After that, I moved to Greece quickly, moved back to Switzerland, and moved to beautiful Portland, Oregon, where I fell in love with the city and the food, and it happened to be, I felt pretty ripe for the product in my whole dream, and now we're here. And that was the cliff note. So a quick rundown of how it all goes.
Well, now, I can't pass by mentioning that the photographs in this book, they're so mouth-watering, I can't explain. If nobody's ever been in one of these salumi factories, they're really in for a knockout experience looking at how many of these salamis are hanging at a time in a place. And we went to the King of Culatella in Friuli. And how many did he have hanging up?
He had about 6,000. He was a little light. He only had about 6,000 hanging there. And many of them had the names of the restaurants they were going to go to.
Yeah, that's a steady inventory. I bet it smells amazing.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah, it smells amazing. So anyhow, you interweave your life story and these incredible photographs of the product and of the people involved in your life into this cookbook with real recipes as well. How do you organize this, all this information?
Yeah, well, first off, Eric Wolfinger needs a little love for taking those beautiful photos.
Oh, incredible.
Me and him became really, really amazing friends, and it was an absolute pleasure, and he's so invested. And, you know, we had no food styling, and it was just me and him hanging out taking pictures, and Meredith Erickson, of course, and he just has this amazing energy that makes you want to take beautiful pictures and go the extra mile to make it beautiful. So, Eric Wolfinger, I love you. You're out there.
Well, I don't know him, but I love him too.
Yeah, he does amazing. He's absolutely a brilliant man. My goal with the charcuterie recipes, as I started talking to Meredith, she's like, could you make these accessible for the home cook? I always wanted to teach, and I always still do teach, that to make delicious charcuterie, you do not need much more than you probably have at home already. I mean, if you have an oven, a vessel, and a knife, you can produce the first whole chapter of recipes with never having a grinder. So I kind of wanted to set it up like a curriculum where you could start at the very basics, learn how to make rillettes, capicola, copa di testa, and literally just using a knife and an oven and a vessel, you can make delicious, some of the most amazing treats. And then if you love the process, then you could move further on and, you know, purchase a grinder, maybe a pate mold, and even further on you could purchase a stuffer and teach yourself how to make sausages, and then at the very end, dry curing, where you're going to, smoke houses, and then move into dry curing, where you have these big rooms and you're creating environments to dry meats and so on and so on. And so it's kind of set up is you can get as deep into it as you would like to, and or you could just start at the end if you have all this stuff and make fermented sausages.
Yeah, now, one thing, though, you emphasize that even though these are all doable, you can't take shortcuts.
No. Absolutely.
Especially with measurements. I think a lot of people are terrified of poisoning themselves and others making, curing meats. And you talk about it, you give it guidelines for safety steps.
Absolutely. It is very important to me that I wanted people to know that it can be a little bit dangerous. It doesn't have to be. There are some rules. It can be very safe. But I just wanted people to really understand and be able to know what they're doing as they're going into it, and being able to do the safety checks, learning how to check pH or water activity in a fermented sausage. It's very crucial to know if you're making a safe product. If you're going to serve it to your loved ones and friends, you might as well go the extra mile to make sure you're not going to poison anybody.
Because you're a risky kind of guy anyway. I didn't read the complete story where it said you almost electrocuted yourself by carving meat outside.
Yeah.
What was the end of it? What was the end of that story?
Well, that was it's actually I actually was working on a stove that wasn't grounded and grabbed an aluminum pot with a wet towel, and it grounded through me, and it was just a horrible experience. Well, that's okay. But, you know, the next day is when I met my business partner, Nate Tilden, on my first trail, or, you know, trying to get a job line cooking, and it turned into quite a fun story when I told him that yesterday I was in a hospital because I was electrocuted. Today I'm making pizzas and trying to make the perfect hamburger, so fast friends.
Now, I promised I would tell you a story, because you have a wonderful chapter on sausages.
Yep.
And the Englishman is almost as much a lover of sausage as the Greeks and Italians. There used to be a television program we watched called Yes Minister, and it then became Yes Prime Minister. And the minister, who was a minister in government, although he was a butt of humor, but he decided that he had to support the British sausage after the European Union declared that it was not enough meat in the British sausage, so it could only be called an offal tube or an offal tube. So he leapt to the defense of the Great British Sausage. As a result, he was elected Prime Minister in a landslide.
Yeah, that's a great angle right now. Some of those politicians we have running right now might want to think about supporting a small little sausage company, maybe.
But you generally do make offal tubes, right? There's no question that's the right way to describe them.
Absolutely, absolutely. Every day, by the thousands of pounds.
Well, yeah, I mean, you somewhere I read where you said you did 8,000 pounds of sausage a day.
I have roughly, that's probably my average.
Jeez.
8,000 to 9,000 pounds of processing. That is anything ranging. My charcuterie plant, we make everything from fermented sausages, fresh sausages, smoked hams, bacon, pâtés. So we make a whole lot of different types of meat here, but it's roughly 8 to 9. Sometimes it goes a little bit over. Sometimes it's a little bit under.
Now, hold on a second. Does Jimmy Dean actually use your breakfast sausage recipe?
No. I wish that it did. I tell you what, though, I did give the gentleman you're speaking of, Mike Boyd, there's a part in the book where he taught me a recipe and approved of my sausage maker, but I showed him that part, and he's probably in his early 80s right now, and he was so excited that he made it into the cookbook. It made it all worthwhile, and he really loved the story, and just an amazing man.
Oh, that's sweet.
For sure.
You're such an expert. You have details that you don't find in your average salumi or charcuterie book. I never, even reading all these books, you know, I got dozens and dozens and dozens of them. Nobody really explained the role of nitrite and nitrates to me. I thought it was something you should avoid for your blood pressure.
Yep, it's definitely, as I say in the book, it has the Fox News effect, like nobody else has ever done. The nitrate and nitrate thing is something in the meat industry we just look at and shake our head because, you know, you consume it in everything. It's natural. Your body produces it. You need it to produce a safe product. And there has been so much wasted energy in my mind to try to fool the people of America that they're not eating nitrate and nitrite in their meats, even though they absolutely are. So, yeah, the way that I wanted to really be clear about it because I also produce nitrite and nitrite-free product with nitrate and nitrite in it just by using celery salts. But I wanted to be very honest with everybody to say that everybody uses nitrate and nitrite. If they're saying they don't, they're most likely lying to you or just producing an unsafe product.
No, that's scary. I mean, you think about what goes in your food, huh?
Absolutely.
Or what doesn't.
Exactly, yeah.
Because I love your Copa de Testa.
Thank you.
I love the photographs of the pig's head. And you smiling and making it look like a pretty package.
Yeah.
I've had experiences with pig's heads staring at me from the counter. And you have to go to some extremes to make this look appealing.
Yeah, that was one of the things that when Eric Wolfinger was taking these photos, and he's done amazing cookbooks, you know, Manresa and the Tartine cookbook, and it's all beautiful topics, you know, subjects like what you're cooking, taking photos of molecular food and beautiful bread baking
exactly.
as we're taking apart this head. And I'm like, it's time to really put your craft to the test, Mr. Wolfinger. Can you make a deboned pig's head look appealing and kind of delicious? And, you know, we had a lot of fun taking those photos and trying to make them pretty, and he's amazing. The stuff that he does with natural light and where he positions and catches interesting colors off of the pig's head and the meat is just fascinating to me.
Yeah,
like but that. Yeah, the Copa de Testa recipe is shockingly one of the recipes in the whole book where I see a lot of people making it, where I'll get an email or,
really?
You know, I'll teach a class and people are actually taking these heads home and making a Copa de Testa and sending me pictures of it, and it's always fascinating to me.
Why is that, do you think?
You know, it's a relatively easy product to make, meaning it doesn't have a grinder, it doesn't have crazy investment, and heads are readily available to butcher shops these days. And I'm not 100% sure people love head cheese. I think it's a stunning picture. It makes a beautiful meat. You don't see it very much. So if you want to try it, you're going to have to make it. I'm not 100% sure why people are doing it. I think it's very delicious. But
love that. You obviously love hot dogs. Explain this hot dog thing. Your Frankfurter specials.
Yeah, so I, for one, am the biggest fan of a real hot dog. I mean, I'm sure you guys are as well. You know, you're sausage fans, where it has a real snap. It's a real sausage. It's not some cheap filler product that tastes like synthetic junk. So I really was excited to make a good hot dog with real garlic, lots of smoke, snappy casings. I made the hot dog. I took it into my restaurants and the creative chefs every Friday. This is probably six years now. They're like, every Friday we're going to do a fun hot dog. We take, you know, we're always relatively serious. We have like charcuterie boards and old world and all these things. And this hot dog for lunch just started initially with the very first one was like the taco dog where they put cilantro and cheese. And then every Friday they come up with a new idea and keep pushing it and pushing it. And it has an amazing following. And so, like, the first one I fell in love with was the enchilada dog in the bottom right corner of the photo there. And I was, you know, a little skeptical, being like, it's not going to be that amazing. And they made real cheese enchiladas with the enchilada sauce, put it on top of a hot dog with a bun, and served it to you with a fork and knife, and I was a changed man. I'm like, you guys keep doing this every week. This is absolutely awesome. And now we're actually in the process of opening up a hot dog stand that only does that 7 days a week. We'll have, like, 10 types of hot dogs. And you can go and get them every day. It's in a new marketplace downtown Portland called Pine Street Market.
Is it going to be a food truck or a real establishment?
It's a real food hall.
Okay.
So there's I think there's eight other restaurants going into it. A lot of the Salt and Straw, Barista, much of the restaurants in Portland are all going in it. Now, having little small concepts.
Let's not forget the fact that in addition to making all these wonderful product, you also have two restaurants.
Yes, sir. Yep.
Talk to us a little bit about those and examples of some of the recipes coming out of there.
We kind of opened them as a little spot that we've always dreamed of, where you'd get really delicious natural old world wine and an amazing plate open all day of delicious food, charcuterie, fresh really fresh, of course, local organic farmer direct vegetables, because you're in Portland, it's just the right way to do it as well. And kind of changes throughout the day. You know, we're open at brunch where it's casual and fun, into a lunch, to a wine hour, and then a little bit more intimate dinner. Some of the recipes that are kind of summing up is, you know, the wine chapters are my favorite. During the day, we do these toasts that have like scorleya and bocarones and chev and cherries and mint on little crunchy toast to enjoy with a glass of sherry. And then in the evening, we always have an amazing beef tartare on and an octopus terrine and lots of delicious fish and braised ribs. And they're quite fun restaurants. Very casual, but also very, very delicious and kind of intimate restaurants.
I'm ready to get on a plane right now.
come on over. We would be more than happy to share a bottle of delicious wine and a meal with you guys anytime.
Now, your steak tartare is special.
Yeah. Alex Yoder, the chef of both of our restaurants, is, we call him the Iron Pony. He's just the most even killed, hardest working, talented man I've ever been fortunate enough to be around. And when he takes on a new dish, it's very precise, and he is a very picky eater, which helps a lot. And he really hated a mushy tartare. And he had these talks forever being like, I love meat that has bite in it, and it's fresh and crunchy, and you can see the different textures. And so once he started, you know, freezing the Terrace Major and slicing it into quarter-inch chunks and then hand-dicing these perfect little tiny dices, and it changed his whole texture. And I, you know, once again bowed to him being like, you are really an amazing chef, Alex Yoder. He's a fascinating man. Quite the tartare.
Oh, well, it sounds great. What is the hardest recipe in this book to make?
I personally think the most difficult recipe in this whole book is the saucisson de Aro. It is a fermented sausage that I'm probably the most proud of. It's a salami that is just cured with just sea salt and pork, fermented then dried. And to be able to pull that one product off, you have to be pretty good at what you do. Every step of the salami process has to be absolutely perfect, from the pork selection has to be of the highest quality, the right amount of flavoring, to the way you ferment it has to be perfect, to the way you dry it, because you have nothing to hide behind. You can't mask the flavor with black pepper or garlic. You literally have to have salt, perfect technique, and patience to pull this one off.
I read that one all the way through. Is that the one that says it takes 22 days to execute the recipe? Or is that a different one?
Yes, sir.
22 days.
Yes, sir. Most of those are around 22 days just to have a piece of salami.
So don't fool around.
Yeah, exactly. Be very patient and measure twice and make sure you do it properly, because I would... It breaks my heart to think that somebody's going to wait 22 days to 2 months on some of these, or 6 months on the Lomo, for example, and it's not going to taste delicious.
Oh, so wow.
Definitely. If it's not perfect.
So tell us about laser potatoes. You have scintillating and challenging concepts in this book, too.
Yeah, the laser potatoes are our brunch. Portland is a very brunchy town, there's no doubt about it. And when we opened up for brunch, right out of the gate, we were extremely busy. My business partner and one other cook decided on their first day that we're going to start doing brunch. And the day they opened the door, it was an hour wait probably to get into the place.
Wow.
Just packed around the corner. And they instantly looked at each other and were like, we cannot make hash browns. It is way too hard to pull off a perfect hash brown. And they brainstormed literally that whole week. And they came up essentially with a Palm Helen, you know, the slowly cooked onions and butter, and layered it and press it and then turn it over. And it makes the most amazing, crunchy, crispy, rich, decadent potato you could ever come up with. And you can do it relatively fast, making the day ahead. I use it all the time if I'm having guests over for breakfast. You know, I can feed 12 people crunchy, beautiful potatoes. The reason it got its name was because one of our cooks, we have an open kitchen, kind of, I guess you would call it like a chef's counter, where you can sit right up at the bar, ask one of the cooks when they're really, really busy, how in the world do they cut these potatoes so thin? And he's like, looks at the person, he's like, we have a small laser in back, and we cut everything laser thin for you. And the lady believed us and asked to see when the server came, and she asked her, could we possibly take a look at this laser that cuts your potatoes? And she was just so, so baffled. But from there on out, it's been labeled the laser potato. And it's,
it's really a fake.
It's just a good old mandolin.
Well, you know, we've talked about delicious. We've talked about lots of information, lucid instructions for the recipes and directions for making charcuterie in general, personal stories, delicious photographs. All of this is in here. We forgot to mention one thing, that you also, anybody listening to this interview must realize, you also have a strain of good humor running through everything.
That's good to hear. Oh, yeah.
I love this. Alp tripping in chicken skin pajamas. Was that a takeoff on the, what is it, the frog?
Yeah, it's in Swiss German, in dialect, it's called, what are they called when you, goosebumps. In English, it's called goosebumps, and in Swiss German, it's called, Pulihut Pajamana. Yeah, and so translated, it's goosebumps
in
chicken skin, pajamas. And, which I've always thought it was just an amazing expression for, you know.
There's a famous novel called Half Asleep in Frog Pajamas.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Huh. What's the author of?
Tom Robbins.
Tom.
Oh, really?
Tom Robbins.
Tom Robbins, who's, yeah. I love Tom Robbins, who's totally mad. But anyhow, half asleep in frog pajamas. Well, I love your book.
I send it to my buddy. Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
I love talking to you, and I look forward to seeing you at some point.
Yeah, me too. Next time you're in town, I would love to get together and have a dinner. That sounds absolutely fantastic.
And my voice ought to be back by then.
Yeah, you take it easy. Have some tea. You deserve a good warm tea right
now. How about whiskey?
That too. That helps as well.
Eli, lots of continued success to you and your business and with this wonderful book.
Oh, thank you very much for having me, and continued success to you too as well.
We should go on record as saying that we actually were kind enough to share our loot from Olympia Provisions with some good friends who came over for dinner
and
just
a
few days ago.
And they raved.
And it's great stuff.
And
the rest of it's gone.
Yeah, gone.
gone until we got more. But Elias, we thank you. And let's see. I guess we've got to move on now, right?
Right. And next up, we're going south, where I'm hoping it's a little warmer, but it's really not that far south.
Yeah, but we forgot to put in a break. So let's put in a break. And then right after the break, we'll start up with Southern Soups and Stews.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Nancy McDermott, I didn't know how you were going to carry off the organization of this book. It was such a broad subject. It's called Southern Soups and Stews, and there are so many of them. So you had some problems too, I guess. This is, by the way, which number for books for you? I mean, you turn up pretty good books here.
This is number 11.
My first
Real Thai came out in 1992, so I've spanned the course of time. And I've actually had, this year I've had two books that went out of print go back into print. I went to a different publisher, and so it's like, okay, do I count those as new books or half books? Or But I've been in the game a long time, so I really feel lucky to have been able to do this, which I love, and which lets me cook with other people, even if I'm not there.
Now, interestingly enough, you've also stayed in one place, pretty much. Your book says you were born and raised in North Carolina, and guess where you live now?
That's exactly right. I did do a little traveling now. My first cookbook writing was a Thai book. I was in the Peace Corps in Thailand, and I really wrote about Asian food until probably about 2002. I lived in Southern California, New York City, and a lot of places, and we moved back to North Carolina 16 years ago in 1999, and that's the first time that I started thinking about Southern food, which I'd always cooked, as a source for exploring more and looking for the stories. Because if there's no story with a recipe, I've got nothing to say about it other than give me some more.
Well, yeah, and you integrated your stories in this book with, instead of having, what do you call those, head notes or whatever those are, you run
right.
them in, next to the recipes
columns. They're left notes. As opposed to right notes.
Side notes.
Top notes and bottom notes.
Like it's all sidebars. they try to rein me in. I can go on for three pages. So they said, please try to hit somewhere within the 200-word range. And so I was as good as I could be.
Well, you have great information in there. I mean, it's a whole other, as I said to you when we were just chatting, I mean, this is not just recipes. I mean, they are stories. I said historian, but you said detective, and you're probably more on the mark than I am with that, because you have all this information you've gathered. Once you figured out how you were going to organize the book, then you actually turned your attention to all the ancillary information to help us enjoy the recipes more. Tell us about your exploration of how to organize this book, because I thought that was interesting, because I was concerned how you would put all this together.
Right. It's kind of, this is my third Southern book, and one difference about this one was I think I was more regional. I know in my Southern Cakes book and my Southern Pies book, I said, okay, these are the dishes from the Low Country. These are pies and cakes of the Low Country, and these are mountain ones. And with soups and stews, they're all over the place. I mean, for gumbo, for example, it's in the Tidewater, it's in the Low Country, it's along the Gulf Coast, it's in Florida, and of course, the one we think of the most is Louisiana, and particularly we think of Cajun gumbo because of Chef Paul Prudhomme, shining the light on the wonders of Cajun food. But those Creole gumbos were there, had been there for 200 years even before I found out about Cajun cooking. So something like gumbo doesn't really fit into one region.
Your university there in North Carolina did is Southern, what's it called, Southern Taste? Southern Savor the South series.
Yes,
they had a whole book
series
on gumbos that we interviewed somebody about.
You also remember the author admitted that she put jambalaya in there as well, because there were only so many gumbo recipes.
And I'm with her, because I put jambalaya, I have jambalaya in here, and I thought, okay, it's my book, so I decide. And I realized that I didn't want to say a stew is something that is stoopy and soupy and has lots of liquid, because I figure stewing is a verb. So something like tomato gravy or shrimp and grits, where it's not the big bowl of gumbo or the big bowl of Brunswick stew, but it is something that starts out with some intense flavors, and you put a little bit of a lot of things in, and there's a seasoning and a bringing flavors together. So that, I thought, it's kind of like when I did a curry book. It's like, a curry is this, but then we can also look at it that way. And that's the great thing. If it's your book, you get to decide.
I see.
Now, the funny thing is, we got a book, what was it, 600 curries or something like that?
Yes, that's my friend Raghavan Iyer.
Okay,
yes.
And you know that, and we were amazed that curry doesn't mean spicy. Curry just means gravy.
Right,
and you probably knew that already.
Well, that's what us cookbook people are, because it's like we sort of get to sit back and think about things, and sometimes it's exactly what everybody thinks, but a lot of times we're saying, hey, let's open this up a little bit. Let's not, I think there's sort of too much of saying, what's the best barbecue, and what's the number one this or that, and who made the first blah, blah, blah. And, you know, those things, they're subjective. We're limited by what was written down and kept. And, you know, if we just, you know, if history is what was written down on paper, we're missing a lot of stuff. So I think we who, those of us who are food writers and food detectives and storytellers, we get to kind of expand things and say, hey, look at it this way. Think about it that way. It makes it more delicious.
Now, let's do this. Let's assume that listeners are going to buy this book. There is one vital piece of information that is not contained therein, which is how many squirrels you need when you're making Brunswick stew. So let's get the word out there. You'll have to correct this in the reprint, which I'm sure is going to come out a few years from now. But how many is it?
Well, I did find a recipe that said 2 squirrels, along with, you know, like 10 hens and 10 pounds of beef, and I thought that was hilarious. How much flavor could you get from 2 squirrels? You know, the squirrels really come from a time when people weren't writing it down. And, you know, of course, you're not going to say, it's not like people were going to the grocery store and buying a certain number of squirrels.
Exactly.
It was, you know, nothing is more use what you've got than what the hunters come back with. And I did, when I was testing, I decided I needed to know about squirrels. And, of course, you can't buy them, and I'm not a very good shot. I'm not a shot at all. But I mentioned to a friend who is in the financial industry, and I just said, boy, I wish I could get a hold of some squirrels. And she said, how many do you need? And the next Monday, she called up and said, can you come by? And she had a clamshell takeout container with about 5 completely dressed, thank God, ready
yes.
for the pot squirrels. And I did make Brunswick stew with squirrels. And what I found out, Peter and Anne, is that it's not a big flavor thing.
It
I mean,
does
I could not
taste
tell
like
that
chicken.
Pot from any other. It's not like lamb or duck or venison where there's something really flavorful going on. People use squirrels because they had them.
They know, had them. There too many of them.
Exactly. No, it's really funny. When we were in Peru, we had guinea pig twice.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, that's a natural dish.
It doesn't really taste very interesting at all.
Right. It's just, there it is.
It's a rat. I mean, it's a rodent. Oh, well.
And, you know, you really can't, we really can't separate our, like, my personal rules about food, where in France it's like rabbit, oh, delicious, and yet in America, there's that Easter Bunny thing, and there's that Peter Rabbit thing, and we're just, most of us are just not going to be able to set that aside. And when I was living in Asia, you know, the affection for cheese was not great in my part of rural Thailand, whereas I just think it's fabulous, but I had a little trouble with that durian, the notoriously odoriferous fruit,
yes.
And it's like, I wanted to love it, but I didn't love it.
It's like that. What is that? The wormy cheese in Sardinia with
I forget what it's called.
It's really smelly.
Yeah, you've tried to blot it out, and I don't blame you. But you know, we like what we like, and that's the great thing about cooking is you can say I like this, I don't like that. I'm going to follow this recipe, but I'm going to change it because I'm out of X, or I don't love Y, or I've got too much something that I want to get rid of. And as the cook, you get to decide.
Now, we keep getting away from this. How did you end up organizing the book?
Yeah. Boy, can I go off on a tangent. I knew.
Me too.
The first thing I do when I have a topic, it's like, okay, it's going to be curries, or it's going to be pies, or cakes, or Vietnamese, or something. I just write down over a couple of days, I make a list of every dish that I can think of that I feel like ought to be in there or I'm curious about. And then, I mean, sometimes I literally put them on index cards and shuffle things, you know, just to sort of see how things come out. And I knew I wanted a gumbo chapter and I wanted a Brunswick stew chapter. And I figured I'd have a vegetables chapter, although that got a little bit tricky. And then, of course, you know, I thought I'd have seafood, but I ended up going with the, you know, fish and shellfish. And then crab and shrimp, because I had so many crab and shrimp recipes that I didn't want to just have seafood. So mm-hmm. those two kind of, I thought there was one category that broke out into two.
I see.
The really interesting one, the one that popped up and surprised me is the soup with dumplings chapter. Now, I knew chicken and dumplings would be in there because that was Miss Nanny's old school chicken and dumplings is, that, you know, that's the other one. It's like, that's what my grandmother made. It's a North Carolina classic. It's flat, noodle-like dumplings, not the puffy, fluffy ones, although I have fluffy ones too. So I thought that, but I thought I'd have a chicken chapter and that chicken and dumplings would be in there. And I quickly realized I don't really have a beef chapter and a pork chapter. I ended up having a meat chapter. And then I ended up putting I've got wild duck that goes over here with the hunter's stews. So it's really a process that I'd say there were about 3 or 4 incarnations before I really settled on what I have. But I love the dumplings because there's matzo balls and there are these cornmeal dumplings that are typical of Eastern North Carolina in particular, where people just made little sort of very sturdy little chewy bits, and they would lay them in on the edges, like just in a circle around the rim of the pan, not around the rim, but around the edge of the pan, right before a certain kind of seafood stew or pot of greens is done. And they were just adding substance. They were adding, you know, something to fill everybody up, just like you might crumble saltine crackers and put them in your vegetable soup. I loved that as a way to stretch and a way to give, you know, to fill something out so that it's a whole meal. The other surprising chapter to me was the beans and field peas.
I was going to mention that. I thought that stuck out.
I'm going to have a vegetable chapter, and that will have, you know, green beans in it. But what about black-eyed peas? Well, they are, you know, they're a bean, although we call them peas. And there are all sorts of ones. There's a mountain dish called leather britches, which is green beans, string beans. They're dried on the pod, and people thread them, a needle and thread, and string them together, and they're hanging up, like maybe out in the, you know, this is in the olden days, in a cabin. They'd be hanging up near the fire, so they'd get sort of a smoky flavor. And, you know, we know that you dry beans and peas, so black-eyed peas were once a fresh field pea, and then they become a dried bean. Well, this is drying the whole outer part, too. You cook them a long time with some kind of side meat, maybe fatback, maybe bacon, maybe ham hocks, and they're chewy and delicious. I didn't end up putting that recipe in because you'd have to start with the beans and string them up and put them by the fireplace. You know, that's one to talk about, but you've got to really be in the Appalachian Mountains or, you know, in the Smokies to come across that dish. But that's the kind of dish where I think there's so much more to green beans than something that's on an elementary school plate lunch.
Yeah, well, now, I mean, you attribute, I mean, they are recipes of some very famous people, like Dookie Chase recipe.
Oh, my goodness.
She is such a doll, isn't she?
She is the most amazing woman, and, you know, I believe she's 91 or 92.
Yeah, we interviewed her right after Katrina.
It was the James Beard Awards. Because the James Beard Foundation awarded the Man of the Year to New Orleans, Louisiana.
Yes. The Chef of the Year, yeah.
And she was there with Brightson, Frank Brightson.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she was just a doll.
And all they wanted to say is, in his case, they said, we're open. She said, we will be open this year. And what we need is you. Come on down now. No, you all come. Show up, we need the business.
Exactly. Wish us well, come eat our food. What a blessing that New Orleans is, you know, recovered and gone on strong. I mean, I can never get tired of going there to eat. And I'm sure you noticed.
Yeah.
I could have had a New Orleans, I could have had a Louisiana chapter or, you know, a Cajun and Creole chapter. I didn't go that far. I felt like the dividing it out by regions, There's too much crossover. There's too much distance.
I mean, we have really good friends. He's a chef, actually, and she loves to cook. They're from Kentucky. I mean, like, she's from one side of the mountain. He's from the other side. And they fight over this burgoo or whatever it is recipe.
Yeah, exactly. And she won't use his cooking pots and utensils, and he won't use hers.
Oh, my goodness. It's not a marriage. It's a truce. I love that. I love that people are so passionate. I mean, I don't want people to start punching each other in the nose. People care about food and that they argue and that, you know, here in North Carolina, it's like, well, you know, we don't argue about whether it should be pork or not. Of course it's pork. But should it be whole hog or should it be a pork shoulder? And should it be smoked over hickory wood or is it okay to use another kind of wood? And should that sauce be, you know, sort of a red, more tomatoey sauce or should it be the vinegar-based? And, you know, it's just, it's all in good fun. It's like your sports team. But people really care about it. And I find that very sweet and reassuring.
Now, is this recipe for the Senate bean soup legitimate? Is it the real recipe?
Now, which one?
The one about the Senate.
The U.S. Senate bean
soup. That is absolutely legitimate. I mean, that is, and, you know, at first I didn't think about it being Southern, and then I was talking to someone about it, and they said, well, of course it's Southern. Who was cooking in Washington, D.C., in the U.S. Capitol at the turn of the century? It would have been African-American cooks, most likely, and it would have been, and Washington, D.C. is a Southern city. I mean, it's an international city. It's much more than that. But, you know, it's in Virginia. It's in the South.
Well, that took me back a ways because I remember riding that little car with my uncle who was in the House of Representatives.
My God.
And, you know, when I was 16, and he took me for that bean soup. And so I looked at this recipe, and it took me back a ways.
Makes me so happy. Whichever, there's some legislator who did a proclamation to make it the official, you know, it must be served every day. It was not a Southerner. I should have it in there. It was somebody from Illinois or Ohio or somewhere. But of course, you look at it, dried beans, ham hocks, butter, and onions. You bet that's Southern.
Yeah.
And the fact that everybody loved it, that just makes me so happy.
Yeah, and I was thrilled to see, Ben and Karen Barker's soup. I mean, I'm going to make the spicy green tomato soup with crab and country ham. I mean, that sounds fabulous.
Will they ever come back, do you think?
Well, I am happy to be able to give you the news. They are in the process of opening a pizza restaurant. I believe it's going to be called Pizza Mercado. I think Mercado is Italian word for market.
It is.
It's near the Carrboro Farmers Market, and Chapel Hill and Carrboro are adjoining towns. I mean, they're distinctive, but they're right together.
Yeah, it's funny. Why do all these chefs they dump their upscale restaurants, which I understand, and then when they turn to a less more casual place, it's always pizza.
That pizza thing. I think you can fill up the place with pizza and then serve other things too. But their son, Gabriel, is going to be the executive chef. So they're involved, and I'm sure they'll be there a lot. I think one thing for them, not in no way are they too old, but I think they found, you know, that the restaurant life is all consuming. And so I think the more casual place is one where you can go and you can be there, but you can also travel to Italy and go enjoy the parents and so forth. But I'll tell you what, this community is so excited. My husband asked me today if they'd opened up yet, so is early in the new year or maybe in the spring, but that was great news out.
Oh, yeah.
And don't you love that photograph? I just praise the photographer, Lee Besh, every day. And one thing that I just really love in the book is these pictures that are a still life, you know, so it's not always the cooked dish. We've got green tomatoes and jalapenos in a colander and a corner of a beautiful dishcloth and a big bowl of pink crab and a slab of country ham. And so it's not the finished dish. It's sort of the inspiration, like a medieval, you know, one of those still life paintings. I just love that she did that.
Well, Nancy, we could talk on forever, but I guess I have to rush and make chicken bog. Doesn't that sound appetizing?
That is so tasty. There's hardly a simpler dish, and I tell you what, if you just don't have time to think, there's not a quicker. You know, I mean, it takes a little time to cook, but that is just such a simple one, and you can put salsa with it, or you could, you know, toss in greens, or you could goose it up, but that's just that's perfect this time of year when you're, you know, you want something hearty, but you maybe don't have a whole lot of time to do it.
Now listeners, two pieces of advice, however. This is not a diet book.
And, no, it's not.
And this is not a vegan book either. So there.
Peter, I knew you were gonna say that. And when I did the vegetable chapter, it's like, it's, you know, even the vegetables, of course you could leave it out, but it's, you know, and of course someone who knows how to cook, just leave things out, but it's very much, you really do see how much, and I mean, I love the traditional cooking, so I'm always, you know, veering toward the old way, and that using a little bit of meat, a little bit of something salty and hearty to stretch out a pot of greens or to expand, like, you know, like on the cover, the one with the, there's ham hock,
yeah,
in that,
I like it.
In the beans. It's like if you're a vegetarian, you got lots of good choices, but in the old time South, it was a lot harder because that's how people got by.
Well, this is a delightful book, and I wish you well with it, as you've done with all your other books. Much success. Nancy McDermott, and the book is called Southern Soups and Stews.
And what do we say? We say go Heels, right? Is that the deal?
That's exactly what you say. I'm in my husband's office in Durham, North Carolina, which is Duke country, but I'm saying go Heels. Go Heels. I'm just kind of whispering, though.
Got it. Okay, Nancy. Well, we hope they do well. I'm sure they will. I'm sure you'll continue to do well, and I'm sure we'll talk again when another book comes along.
Well, Peter and Ann, I'm always ready to talk to you, and one of these days we'll bring the pot over and cook together. That would be such a fun
that
thing to do.
That would be great. Thanks, Nancy.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Now stay with us, because vegetarians get their time on the program right after the break, so don't go away.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, if all things in the world come to a peak, there's certainly a lot to be said about this latest survey done by the Vegetarian Resource Group about the incidence of adult vegetarians in the United States. We're going to be talking to Charles Stoller. You are a co-director, Charles, of the Vegetarian Resource Group.
That's correct. How are you, Ann? Hi, Peter.
I have a little laryngitis, as you may be able to tell.
Okay. It's that time of year with the allergies.
Yeah.
She was screaming, supporting the Steelers against the Baltimore Ravens.
I don't think so. She
didn't do enough screaming.
She has not yet recovered.
Yeah. I don't blame you.
So, but anyhow, I wasn't shocked by the survey, because it's become very apparent that the number of vegetarians I encounter on a daily basis has certainly increased, as well as, but not to such an extent, as vegans.
Right, I would say so. When I became vegan in 1977, I think I knew a handful of vegans, hardly any. Even vegetarians, I think, was kind of strange. It's interesting, we've been doing an essay contest for kids since about the 1980s, and I would say when kids wrote their essays, they may not know anyone. There might be someone in the school. And today, pretty much almost in every class, there's a vegetarian. So, I mean, that just tells you how much times have changed.
Uh-huh.
Also, you know, as far as products, if you look in grocery stores, almost every grocery store, I think, has soy milk and almond milk and veggie burgers. And that certainly wasn't true 20, 30 years ago.
Right. Well, now, can you summarize your findings in this survey? I mean, how big a survey was it?
Okay, we did a Nielsen-Harris poll, so they survey about 2,000 people, and it's a similar survey to a presidential poll. It's the same, you know, Nielsen, who does these kind of surveys. And a lot of times businesses contact us, or researchers or students contact us, and they want to know how many vegetarians there are. And, you know, anecdotally, we all think there's more, so we've been tracking this since about 1994. And the way we ask the question is, do you never eat meat, fish, or poultry? And the reason we ask it that way is because if you just say, are you a vegetarian, people kind of define it very differently.
Oh, yeah.
So we're trying to track how many there really are. It's nice that people want to say they're vegetarian, and that's also amazing to me, that people are no longer embarrassed about it. Whether they are or aren't, they say they are. But anyway, so we said, do you never eat meat, fish, or poultry? So our answers will be a little bit different because we're using the word never. We had about 3.4% of the population that say they're vegetarian. Probably about 10 to 20% of the vegetarians are vegan also. So a vegan is a vegetarian that doesn't use any animal products, so they don't use dairy or eggs either.
No honey. I learned that from my cousin.
Right, no honey. No honey also, right, exactly, yes. Okay. We also asked the question, do you never eat meat, fish, or fowl one meal a week, one day a week, a little less than half the time, more than half the time? And if we added everything together, that is, the people that are vegetarian all the time or eat some vegetarian meal, at least one vegetarian meal a week or more, we came up with about 36%. So what we're saying is about really over a third of the population are eating at least one vegetarian meal a week, which is incredible. But I think that's why all these new products are out there. You know, that's why in the stores you have veggie burgers in every supermarket, you have soy milk. In the last few years, even almond milk in the supermarket. The vegans, like myself, who are often the loudmouths, you know, we promote those items. But they're really not in there just for us. They're really in there because of that third of the population. It caused it probably to happen, but the other people who want it, it may be people also that are lactose intolerant. They may not even be vegetarian. So there's all different reasons, you know, why people are eating the vegetarian meals.
Of course, the reason was what I was going to ask you, is do you think that it's because people are more conscious of how the animals are harvested and raised, because we've gotten a lot of information about that, or do you think it's for health reasons? I mean, the latest study about eating meat is scary.
Right. I think it's all the reasons people come to it. It could be environment, it could be health, it could be animal rights, it could be animal welfare, it could be economics. What we found from serving our own members and people come to our booths, and these aren't really scientific polls, so they can't be extrapolated necessarily the same way as the Nielsen poll, but whether they come for health or animal reasons, we find they take on all the other reasons, which is interesting. You know, over the years, they may become for health reasons, but then they're concerned about animals, or they may be concerned about animals, and they realize, hey, this is better for the environment and better for my health. What's also interesting is from our own survey, again, not the national survey, but survey, whatever the reason was, people seem to have stayed vegetarian for the same length, whether they were health or environmental or animals vegetarians. I personally, we thought it would be because of the animal reasons they would stay vegetarian longer, but it seemed like it didn't matter because it seemed like they took on the other reasons once they entered. But again, this was more of a poll of our members and people coming to our booths, so it may not apply to the population necessarily.
Charles, bear with me a second. I want you to take us the right way, not the wrong way.
Okay.
I sort of understand vegetarianism,
mm-hmm.
sort of, in that I guess if you don't want to expose animals and fish and things like that to unusual punishment, like, and eventually they finish up dead, before they're on your plate, mm-hmm. then I suppose you can make a case for vegetarianism and understand that, in fact, it's a very sort of highbrow thing to do. Veganism, I just don't get,
mm-hmm.
because you're not killing anybody in the process.
Okay.
The process of creating eggs, the process for creating whole milk, the process for creating a number of things which you as a vegan choose not to eat, seems entirely arbitrary and capricious, and I just don't follow it at all.
Okay, good question. One of my best friends, who I was actually best man for when I was younger, he had a chicken farm, right? And when their chickens were too old to lay eggs, they sent them off to the soup company, right?
Oh, yeah.
Right, so that's what happens to animals once they're too old, which isn't really that old, I think, to be productive. Also, if you're producing milk cows, just like humans, only female cows give milk. So the male cows are actually killed or used for veal especially. So that's really, there's a lot of deaths really is caused also by the dairy and eggs. So that's the reason why some people may be vegan.
How about honey?
Honey? Honey's, you know, again, vegans don't use honey. People have different opinions on honey. I guess what some people say is because they'll smoke out the hives and they're really bad. I think with the honey, different people look at it differently.
No, bear with me again. Let me continue to be a nuisance.
That's
because,
good, yeah.
Because
you're ready to be a vegan if you want to be a nuisance, right? You're getting there. You're just like us, a nuisance.
it seems to me that there's a very slender thread between a cow and its eventual end of life situation, and for example, a piece of cheese, or a cup of yogurt. I just will never get it, I suppose.
Okay.
But I also heard somebody say once upon a time on this program, I think, that carrots actually do squeal when you pull them out of the ground.
Right, but they can't. they can't run away from you because they don't have nervous systems. You know, I guess it's like if someone has a pet dog, I don't think they would step on its tail. Or they know that it's in pain if they step on its tail. If they step on a carrot, maybe, but, you know, it's hard to believe. Because they can't run away, so they don't need to have that nervous system.
So, I mean, Peter really firmly believes that you hurt carrots if you pull them.
Well, I'm taking a rather obscure position there, only because I think the position that vegans take seems to me to be extraordinarily obscure.
Yeah, well, actually, without the dairy industry, it would be very hard to have cheap meat. So you really are supporting the dairy industry. And also, basically the egg industry, it exists because they sell those chickens to be used for meat and soup or in other items. So there really is a relationship, and I think that's how many vegans see it. They see all the relationships.
Well, there's so much passion involved in this whole thing. I wrote an article for City Magazine on vegetarians, our vegetarianism, and I've never had so many outcries from practicing vegetarians. they were threatening.
Yeah, I think, all people are different. I think you have the noisy vegetarians and the quiet vegetarians, just like you have noisy meat eaters and quiet meat eaters. I think if you look at politics, right, people like excitement right now. I think a lot of politicians have nothing to do with vegetarianism, but I think people make extreme statements to get attention, whether they believe it or not. So I think that applies across the board, to all human endeavors.
Since I took several cheap shots, let me be fair and have you take a few minutes to express what you think is the compelling case for a vegetarian diet because it's healthier.
Well, I'm not a dietitian, so I can't necessarily speak to the health aspects. However, most studies say that a whole foods, somewhat lower fat diet is healthier. Seventh-day Adventists, it's a type of religion, and half of them are vegetarian, but they all don't drink alcohol. There's been a lot of studies on them comparing, and they say that health-wise, they tend to do better. This doesn't mean just because you're vegetarian, you will definitely be healthier. You could drink beer and eat potato chips and be a vegetarian, and you could be a meat eater and drink beer and eat potato chips. So, there may not be a big difference. But in general, most studies have, again, not being a dietitian, but most studies have shown generally in Mediterranean-style diet, people do better with, which is more grain. Most cultures, except for Western cultures, really don't have meat at the center of the meal. So if you ever gone to a Chinese restaurant, in general, meat is a little bit within the vegetables or within the grain. Indian food is certainly that way. Even other countries in South America, Mexico, generally there's less meat that people eat than the amount of meat that we all eat.
Yeah, which is excessive.
Here's a tricky one for you. Is wine okay? Is wine vegan?
Some wine is, some wine isn't. As far as being vegan, some wine is filtered through fish bladder. So if it's made that way, it may not be considered technically vegan. What's interesting is we did a poll a while ago. We did a survey on the people that said they eat one or more vegetarian meals a week, and they're not necessarily vegetarian, right? So we said, would you eat sugar if it was filtered through bone char? Most sugar, cane sugar, is filtered through bone char if it's not organic.
Really?
And the majority actually said they wouldn't. But these were meat eaters, so it actually made no sense because if they're meat eaters, they're eating animals, they're eating food off the bone, they're chewing on their bone, right?
Yeah.
Why, if these are meat eaters saying they wouldn't eat it, so it just sounded bad to them.
Here was my point, Charles, and you may not realize this, but egg white is used quite often in the fining process for clarifying wine.
Right.
And we have heard some people telling us, I think, over the years that they try to find out whether or not that's been done to a particular wine, but it's not required on the label.
Right.
So what do you do?
Right. It is difficult. So you need to contact the wine companies, and you need to ask them. It's interesting about wine because I think now isn't egg considered an allergen? So in food, I guess they have to report it, I think. I'm not positive. A lot of these ingredients are very hidden, so you really do need to contact these companies. On our website, www.vrg.org, we actually have a list of hundreds of ingredients that may or may not be animal-derived.
Right.
At vrg.org. So anyone interested may want to go look at that list. So at least give them a hint when they're looking at the label what they can question the company about.
Now, Charles, is your organization would we call it a leading organization on vegetarianism?
I think we lead other people, yes. We encourage, we lead, we assist. Yes, we do all that.
I mean, is it like the biggest or the most referred?
We're one of them. I mean, you know, there's different organizations out there.
What are some of the other organizations?
The other organizations... there's a lot of different kinds of organizations. Like, for example, I mentioned there's Seventh-day Adventist. I mean, of course, those are religious. There's Hindus. Those are religious. There's, you know, PETA is an animal rights organization.
Yeah.
Which is a little bit different. Some people support animal rights, so they're coming in from that way. Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine is sort of an animal rights health organization that people support. So there's really a lot of different groups out there.
Yeah, but
I think Vegan Outreach, I think, originally was from Pittsburgh.
I think
they moved, but they actually were from Pittsburgh.
Well, we read this article. I'll tell you, we had a lot of adamant vegan groups.
We could be strong-willed, definitely.
I'm trying to figure out if I got half a point. As for my lunch today, I had chicken livers sautéed in ghee. But with some black beans and lentils and quinoa on the side.
Okay, what did you have for breakfast?
Breakfast I had fruit and nuts.
So you're a third vegetarian.
Oh, there you go. Good.
See that? Yeah. Plus you're nuts too, so you're even more vegetarian, right?
Oh my God, what a relief.
All right. See? You're going to be on our side of the fence soon.
Yeah, but Anne's a real sinner because she had boiled eggs.
Not vegan, but vegetarian. Okay.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, where do you think this is going to end up? I mean, it just, I follow Mark Bittman. We've known him for a long time. And his health got so out of control. And being a food writer, you know, he had to come up with a plan where he would not kill himself with this food eating and so forth. So he started out with this vegan till 6. And then he had a regular omnivore, carnivore, whatever, dinner. But now he's just left the New York Times and he's in San Francisco heading up a vegan group called Purple Carrot.
Uh-huh.
And he's a very, very influential guy.
Uh-huh.
And we had somebody who has a animal sanctuary on, and I had never heard of him, but apparently vegetarians had, because we had 7,000 hits within the hour.
Amazing.
Yeah. And so where is this heading?
Yeah. Well, again, when I became vegetarian, like in 1975, vegan in 77, I never thought we'd be at where we are today. I never thought there'd be this many vegetarians or vegans, but I think eventually mostly everyone will be vegetarian most, you know, and it might be economics, and I think part of it's just that there's more and more good food available and people are going to be creating good food. So it's really going to be because of convenience. That's what's going to be out there, and it's just going to make sense for all the reasons. Doesn't mean everyone will be vegetarian 100% of the time, but now there's so many more substitutes than there used to be. I mean, it's incredible to me when I go in the supermarket and I see how many that almond milk is there. I mean, how much soy milk and almond milk?
Cashew, everything, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, again, back in the 70s, if you wanted soy milk, you ordered powdered soy milk through the mail. Now it's actually in the dairy case. There's meat analogs in the dairy case. It's interesting, sort of related, but our local large supermarket, I guess back in the 80s, they were adding organic food, right? And they had no idea what they're doing. Someone from here was on their consumer board, and they're wrapping it in plastic. And she was trying to explain to them, anyone that wants organic food doesn't want it wrapped in plastic. Right? They didn't understand that. Right? But now they're beginning to understand. So, you know, on every front, I think we're moving forward.
Well, I mean, I really believe that it's probably the wave of the future. And thank you for taking the time to talk to us about it and to discuss your very interesting, I'd say even compelling, survey. Thank you, Charles.
Thank you. Okay, thank you for doing the show.
We'll be back Same time, same place next week. We hope that Anne will re-find her voice. In the meantime,
I have.
Yeah. Well, we have a synchronicity issue here.
Synchronicity is a good word.
Those of you who even heard last week's program know that a dramatic recovery has been made, and we're all very pleased about that, because that means that we can be back with you again, same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye bye.